From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, venture capitalist and PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel joins us to discuss his thoughts on capitalism, innovation, and entrepreneurial success. We'll also get his take on college, which he thinks is often a waste of time, and find out why he believes our society fears change and technology. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Peter Thiel joins us in studio for the second Forum hour this morning, an inventor, entrepreneur, and venture capitalist. He's also co-founder of PayPal and Palantir Technologies and a major investor, was in Facebook and funder of such companies as SpaceX and LinkedIn. He also founded the Thiel Foundation and is the author of Zero to One. Notes on Startups or How to Build a Future, based on lectures delivered by him at Stanford, his alma mater. He joins us for the second hour in studio. Good to have you here.
Michael, thanks for having me on the show.
You've come a long way from Foster City, I must say.
not that far geographically, but it's been a crazy few decades. It certainly has.
Well, maybe we can look back, but I want to look forward because right now, very much in the news, the eBay split off from PayPal into a separate company. In fact, there's a lot of buzzing about it and so forth. And there essentially means greater profits or has meant greater profits for PayPal that I think inspired this to a great extent. Carl Icahn said they should have. He was pressing for it for quite some time. For PayPal to just go on its own. But what does this mean from your perspective as one of the co-founders?
Well, it made a lot of sense for PayPal and eBay to combine back in 2002. About two-thirds of PayPal's payment volume took place on eBay. And then as PayPal has grown over the years, it's gradually diversified outside of the core eBay auction business. By 2008, it was less than half on eBay. At this point, it's maybe a quarter or a little over a quarter on eBay. And so, as that's happened, as these businesses have diverged, I think it is natural to ask these questions and look at whether spinning it out as a standalone business makes sense in a way that it wouldn't have a decade ago.
And they're going to have two separate CEOs, Dan Schulman and Devin Wenig. So it's two operations now, really.
Yeah, I think it's like an auction business and a payments business. The payment space was an area where not much happened for many years, I'd say, much of the latter half of the last decade. But the last few years, there's been a lot with mobile payments. There are a lot of newer payments companies coming on. And so I think having a focus on the product will be very critical for PayPal's success going forward.
It's kind of your baby to a great extent. I mean, you feel good about this or does it not – it's out in the world now beyond you? And
It's sort of a well past adolescent kid at this point. So still have a certain sense of attachment to it, but haven't been involved for 12 years and out of my control.
It's a little bit like when you write a book, which is a good segue to talk about your book because this is a book which really talks about technology mattering more than globalization. I mean, invention and creation and too much emphasis maybe from your perspective, people who go into businesses and they decide, well, I'm going to make a better typewriter instead of thinking of making a better typewriter. Think about word processor. That's kind of the metaphor here.
Yes. The metaphor is that if we think about how have living standards improved over the last few centuries and really big picture, I would argue it's been through technology, science, new inventions that have really improved living standards, whether it's computers or medicine, transportation, energy, all sorts of different areas. And so I think it is as we look ahead for the rest of the 21st century, I think continued innovation in technology will be really critical. And it's especially so for those of us living in the developed world, U.S., Western Europe, Japan. I think the developing countries like China have a lot of room to catch up, so they can actually do a lot just by copying things. But if we're going to have – if the younger generation in the U.S. will have a better living standard than their parents, we need to have a lot of technological progress.
Well, you are kind of a technological missionary, if I could say, put it in that context, and really have almost a proselytizing method to some of the things you say about technology and how it enhances life and how important it is. What do you say, just out of curiosity, because I know you're a philosophy major, what do you say to the Luddites who say, you know, technology is making it harder to create intimacy, it's making it more difficult to have personal relationships and interrelationships, taking us away from those kinds of things?
Oh, I don't think that particular critique is valid. I mean, I certainly think that the internet, the communications revolution, the social networking revolution has brought people closer together. It's enabled people to form more and better friendships. Better relationships. So I think it's on the whole been very much much a positive. I don't think all technology has been positive. So I think, you know, I think the development of nuclear bombs, we can certainly say was probably negative and certainly very debatable in terms of what that did in this last century. And so I'm not a techno utopian, but I do believe that without building the right sorts of technologies in the decades ahead, we will face a stagnant and a very pessimistic future.
You're also talking about, in some ways, how a kind of new paradigm. I mean, it's implicit in your title and the idea that people need to, well, in fact, you say competition is not necessarily a good thing, but monopoly is. You want to define that for us?
Well, this is my core how-to advice to an entrepreneur or a founder is when you start a business, do something that's unique. Do something where you're not in ferocious competition with other people. If you want ferocious, Darwinian, you know, nature-bared, red and tooth and claw competition, you should open a restaurant in San Francisco. if you want to build a great business where you have so many profits, you can treat your employees incredibly well, do something like Google where you have a monopoly and you haven't had competition in 12 years. And so I think this choice between breakthrough technology leading to monopoly versus incremental change leading to sort of extremely competitive businesses with very, very narrow margins is always underestimated by the people who start these companies. And so I think this is a very important thing for people to think about. Now, on the outside, from the point of view – so I think on the inside, monopoly is always a good thing. On the outside, from the point of view of society as a whole – it can be a very bad thing. It can become sort of a rent collector, a toll collector, like in the Parker Brothers board game.
Or an abuser of power.
Or an abuser of power, you know, where you're sort of restricting supply of something. But I think as long as you have a dynamic system where you're creating new things, you're not creating artificial scarcity. When Apple invents the iPhone, it finally creates a smartphone that works. It has a monopoly on that for many years, but it's created something new. And you know, the monopoly is what it gets for that invention. We have this reflected in our legal system with copyright laws and patent laws, and something like that is the intuition behind this.
Wasn't the PayPal idea looked upon by some business journalists as one of the worst ideas for business in the decade or something along those lines?
Well, our original idea was quite bad, which was using infrared beaming port on Palm Pilots to beam money. It was is one of the 10 worst ideas of 1999, which was a year full of rather crazy ideas.
Well, it was a year you're right about. In fact, you bring back all those parties and all that craziness and all that expectation. And it doesn't have to be always boom and bust, boom and bust, boom and bust. Or
I think that there is some boom bust. There are some boom bust dynamics. I don't think we need completely crazy bubbles of the sort that have dominated our society in the last few decades. We had the internet bubble in the 90s, you know, a really crazy housing finance bubble in the last decade, and I think these enormous bubbles have been on net quite destructive. And there's a question whether they could have been prevented or could have, you know, in one way or another. And I think that's an important question to think about.
Our guest is Peter Thiel, if you've just joined us, and his new book is called Zero to One, Notes on Startups or How to Build the Future. We were just talking about China in the last segment with Orville Schell, and you talk about China in your book as going on this different path despite all of its capitalism, post-Mao, as copying.
Well, I think that's the right thing for China to do. I think they have a lot to copy. It's working. It's worked quite well for them on the whole over the last 30, 40 years. It's possible it hits a limit at some point. So, you know, if everybody in China just gets a gas-powered car like in the U.S., maybe you get too much pollution or you run into resource constraints globally. So there may be some limits to how far China can get away with copying, but it's worked quite well to date.
On the other hand, when you talk about the United States and moving forward, you're really talking about an economy that's based on and ought to be based on this continual propensity toward creation and inventiveness and the kind of things that represent original ideas. And in fact, you pose a question early on in your book, and it's a question worth asking our listeners. You want to ask it?
Well, there's the business version is what great business is nobody building. But the more intellectual version of this is tell me something that's true that very few people agree with you on. And this is always a fantastic interview question. It's really hard for people to answer, even though it sounds like a really easy question.
So, would you ask people when you interview them for jobs?
I do. People read about it on the internet. They know that I'm going to ask it to them, but they're still find
still
it quite
be stymied.
Hard. They still find it hard. It's one of these questions where even if you know it's coming, it's hard.
It's also is it true that you won't look at somebody to invest in if they wear a suit?
That was taking a little out of context. In the book, I said that there were a lot of things wrong with the clean tech companies of the last decade, but a lot of them were run by people who transparently looked like salesmen. And so if you were wearing a suit in a pitch in Silicon Valley, you looked like you were bad at sales and worse at tech.
You're looking for vision here, really, aren't we? Isn't that the word? When you talk about originality, you're really talking about vision, envisioning something really vis-a-vis the future.
You're looking for a vision with a certain amount of detail to it, so not just a sort of right. super abstract vision, but with some detail.
In fact, you say be kind to the salespeople because they're really much more important than
and
they
then
are.
You need to convince people of it. Yes, yeah. Yeah, so you need to convince people of the vision, and you need to have a team of people that somehow works together really well. It's rarely a solo effort that just one person can do all on their own.
You know, there was an article that really went after you by Michael Lind. I don't know if you're familiar with the article, but there was this what he called puff piece in Fortune. Actually, it was really kind of a nice send-up piece talking about you as one of our leading public intellectuals and comparing you to Thorsten Veblen, no less. And Lind felt he had to knock that down. I think being an iconoclast and being a guy who doesn't perhaps like your libertarian philosophy, you think of yourself as a public intellectual?
It does sound somewhat pretentious, so I'd be very uncomfortable describing myself that way. But I do like thinking about ideas, and I think I'm mostly focused on this question of how we can innovate in technology and science, and how this fits into a lot of other questions in our society. So I do think it intersects with many other issues, but that's the prism through which I look at things.
Well, one of the issues that you've been public about that you've taken probably a considerable amount of heat about is this idea that maybe college education isn't necessary or for many people it's a waste of time, even help pay for a number of young people to really sort of drop – it was featured on 60 Minutes, I believe.
Yes.
Drop out of college and, you know, go on and become entrepreneurs and so forth. I was wondering about the message of this, particularly in light of the fact that you had a good liberal arts education and it served you well. I mean, you quote Nietzsche in your book and so forth. I mean, this has all been enhancing your life, I presume, to a great extent, hasn't it?
You can never run the experiment twice, you know, and so it's always hard to know how things would have turned out if I would not have gone to Stanford undergrad and law school and done the things I did. But I think my view on education today is it has changed some because there's so much more student debt involved than there was 25 years ago when I went to college, or 40 or 50 years ago when a lot of the baby boomers went to college and they sort of had a very different college experience from that a lot of the millennials are having. So I do think this problem with the student debt has forced us to ask certain questions about education that were not being asked 40 or 50 years ago. And I guess my sort of overarching idea is that there's no one size fits all. You know, it's not that all the people should go to the same top colleges or should be trying to go to the same top colleges. And we have to somehow as a society move beyond this idea that you go to Yale or you go to jail,
Never heard that one before. No.
But that there are some other things people should be able
to
do.
Well, technical schools, trade schools, I mean, there's really a case to be made for them as opposed to that everybody should get a liberal arts education. But the idea of – we had Michael Roth on, who is now president of Wesleyan University, and he essentially made a brief for the liberal arts education, said how much it extends consciousness, how much it enhances you as a human being and everything. And
I'm,
Maybe the, I guess what I want to get at here, take off my professor's hat though, but what about the message to young people? You know, you say Bill Gates, and you haven't said necessarily, but many have said Bill Gates didn't graduate college, Steve Jobs didn't graduate college, Mark Zuckerberg didn't graduate college. Why need a sheepskin when you can learn coding? Why study the liberal arts for that matter, and the arts in general, when you can just learn coding or go in a technical field?
Well, I don't think there's a one size fits all. So I think that I think a liberal arts education is a great education to have if you really have it. I think in many cases it ends up being sort of a set of courses that are like really easy and people aren't pushed that hard. But I think if you have a liberal arts education in which the students are pushed very intensely,
there's still some of us in the academic trade who push.
I'm sure you do this, but that can be very powerful. But I don't think there's a one size fits all, and I think different people are good at different things, interested in different things, and we shouldn't try to make them all fit into a single mold.
You may be inspiring a lot of people, though, to think, gee, I can do a startup, I can be an entrepreneur, I can be an inventor, and the fact is, in many instances, they just don't have the DNA or don't have what it takes.
Oh, I've never claimed that everybody should be an entrepreneur. I think that it would be good if we had somewhat more entrepreneurs, at least doing some of these zero to one companies that I describe in my book, where you're working on major innovation. I think there's sort of a lot of trivial types of innovations where it's very debatable whether we have too few entrepreneurs.
Well, you have been provocative on this, as evidenced by the fact that we're getting some online comments pouring in already, just right on point here. Listener writes, Teal seems to be saying that I got rich despite the terrible burden of my Stanford law degree and all the privileges it brings in society. Thus, you don't need to go to college and we don't need to fund public education.
Didn't say that precisely. I didn't precisely say that. But I don't think you can run this experiment twice. I think that, I think it worked out well for me. I think that there were a lot of great people I met at those places. But if I had to give advice to my younger self, I might still go to Stanford. I probably would still go to Stanford. I might still go to law school, but I'd ask a lot more questions why I was doing it. And I think at the time I was doing so much of it for status and prestige and not as much as I should have for the substance of really being interested in learning the things I was learning. And, I ended up at a big law firm on Wall Street. From the outside, everybody wanted to get in. On the inside, everybody wanted to leave. One of the people down the hall told me I was reassured to see me leave. I left after 7 months and 3 days. He was reassured to see me leave because he had no idea it was possible to escape from Alcatraz. And all you had to do was go out the front door. But mentally, people's identities were so wrapped up in the tracked things they had done that it was inconceivable for people to do that. So I do think
Were you doing all the billing of hours there, though? Were you playing the game?
That's what you do at all these firms. You have lots of you measure out your life in billable hours.
That's exactly what it is, until you become a partner, and then you have to keep those billable hours going and be a rainmaker. Talking to Peter Thiel, who is here with us in studio, and he is the author of a new book, and it's called Zero to One, Notes on Startups or How to Build the Future. Let me talk to you about some other things that you've been public about and that really you get to in the book as well. The idea of Constitution of the United States and freedom not compatible with democracy?
Well, we're living in a constitutional republic. We're not in a democracy, strictly speaking. In a country of 300 million people, you can't have everybody vote on everything. You might be able to do this in a small village of 1,000 people in Switzerland or something like that. So we have a representative republic, and then it's not really republican. It's modified by the Constitution, which further limits what people can do. And then over the last 80 or 90 years, that's also been modified through all the government agencies, which sort of run in this somewhat autonomous way. And that's what you need in an advanced technological society. It can't work as a democracy. And so this is always sounds like a really shocking insight, but you couldn't, it's way too complicated a society to vote on everything.
And women getting to vote in 1920, where does this tie in? You've said some things about that have caused stir.
That was taken very out of context. I sort of corrected that within a week.
So you didn't really mean that the enfranchisement of women was something questionable?
I don't think people's rights to vote should be taken away in any context. I'm skeptical that it makes as much of a difference as people think, because the most important decisions in our society don't get voted on.
Can you say something also about the Seasted movement? Maybe just again to bring more illumination in people's minds, because in most people's minds, this is something that has to do with microstates that would be sovereign, presumably, that would maybe even, this is kind of uber-libertarianism in a way, but it's also the idea that maybe citizenship ought to be given second thoughts?
Well, certainly...
citizenship as we know it, yes.
Well, certainly one of the seasaying thing is probably not going to happen anytime soon. This is a very small
side project
at the foundation. Let's make that clear. But the part of it that has gotten a lot of interest is because there is always this sense that the frontier is closed. There is no place left to move in this world. And this is very different from the 18th, 19th century where people could move west and they sort of, you know, this was California was sort of the end of the frontier in a way. And so it always generates a lot of interest and speculation because, you know, how would we organize communities? How would we organize a new society if you could actually start over? And when you start that thought experiment, people have different views. It doesn't have to be libertarian. It could be a socialist utopia. It could be all sorts of different societies that people could try.
We had Paul Ryan on earlier today. I don't know if you happened to hear it in the first hour. And we weren't talking about libertarianism, but we were talking about something that certainly ties in with libertarianism, which is the idea that he's come out with a new book as well. And he's kind of, I suppose, as some real true libertarians would see it, maybe backtracking, although essentially he takes a position and says that in his book as well, government involvement really stymies free market, it stymies corporate growth, it stymies all the kinds of things that make for a strong economy. That's pretty much aligned with your thinking?
I'm always focused on the questions of science and technology specifically. So I'm not going to comment on all these other areas. I definitely think it's a complicated story. There's a history where government has been able to push things. It was able to do the Manhattan Project. It was able to do Apollo, get people to the moon. It's been, I think, less effective at that in recent decades, and it's a very important question why that has changed. I believe that it's for a variety of reasons less capable of doing these things than it was in the past,
and especially with respect to social progress and reform.
With respect to scientific and technological projects,
you're talking strictly about science and technology.
That's the area I'm most focused on. Now, politically, I am libertarian in the sense I'm socially liberal, fiscally more conservative. But I always have the schizophrenic view on politics because on the one hand, I think it's important. On the other hand, I think it's endlessly frustrating. Nothing ever changes. And so I happily spend most of my time trying to do things in technology rather than politics.
Well, you did like the Ron Paul candidacy. You were behind it, I believe, weren't you?
I supported Ron Paul. I thought that it was good to try to shake things up a little bit on the Republican side. I think it's good to have a candidate who's less pro-war. It's good to have a candidate who's asking some of these civil liberties questions.
Again, if you just joined us, our guest this hour is Peter Thiel. He's here with us in studio, and opportunity for you who are listening to join us, not only in conversation, but any questions you might have for him. Certainly been a controversial figure, but also a leading figure in technology and in science and investments, and certainly I think many of you probably would like to talk to him. So an opportunity to do that. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us again at our toll-free number right now at 866-733-6786. Number of other ways of communicating, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us. When we come back, Peter, ask you something about Twitter. It's... kqed.org is our Twitter. I'm sorry, at kqed.org. At KQED Forum. Thank you, Dan. By the way, Peter Thiel will be at the Commonwealth Club tonight in Santa Clara at 7 p.m. He'll also be at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco next Monday, October 6th at 7 o'clock. But feel free to join the program now. Again, his new book, 0 to 1, Notes on Startups or How to Build a Future. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal and co-author of the new book, 0 to 1, Notes on Startups or How to Build a Future. This actually began, this book is you giving lectures at Stanford, and then there were blogs, and a guy with the enviable name of Blake Masters joined forces with you. That's kind of the genesis, yeah?
Exactly. So it was basically I tried to teach a class where I conveyed everything I've learned about business and technology companies in Silicon Valley, took a blogged about the class, got an enormous amount of readership, and then we decided to try to turn it into a book.
Can you teach people these kinds of skills, though? You know, it strikes me that I know you're a chess player, that some of these things are almost innate, you know, being a gymnast, being a chess maker, being a novelist, or for that matter, being a technological wizard.
Entrepreneurship is quite hard to teach because there is no actual formula, you know. And I think a lot of the business books that get written are sort of these pseudo-scientific books where you have like this formula, these are the five steps you follow. And I think the problem with formulas is that every moment in business happens only once. The next Bill Gates won't build an operating system company. The next Mark Zuckerberg won't build a search engine. If you're copying these people, in some sense, you're not learning from them. And so
like the Chinese.
Well, they can do it, but the technology version of this does not work. And so the point of departure for my book is this anti-formulaic insight. So it's you have to do something unique. The monopoly question becomes very important. I can't tell you what the substance of your business should be. You have to figure that out yourself.
So what do you hope the effect or impact of this book will be?
I hope that it stimulates people to thinking a little bit more creatively about a range of things, about the future generally. And then obviously I hope that within Silicon Valley and elsewhere, it encourages people to take the leap and build some of these great new companies.
All right. Before we went to the break, I said I was going to ask you about Twitter. And again, you say it's horribly mismanaged by a bunch of pot smokers or something along those lines.
This is like the telephone game.
Well, it's an opportunity for you to just clear up what sometimes is distorted on the internet. One of the problems with the internet that it distorts so many things, right?
I did say that it had a history of being horribly mismanaged, and that there was probably a lot of pot smoking going on, not necessarily on the management level. Dick Costolo, the Twitter CEO, in a very good humor, tweeted back that he didn't have time to respond since he was busy eating a large bag of Doritos. But I think the way I meant it was actually in a way as a compliment to Twitter as a business. The 140 character idea that they had is so unique and so distinctive that they have no competition. And when you have a business where the business model is so good and there's no competition, it can actually be pretty mismanaged, and it can still be a really valuable company that keeps growing. And so that's sort of the silver lining to it.
You were asking me off air about favorite short stories. Actually, David Mitchell was on last week, a very prominent writer, British writer, and he tweeted out his short story that later became a novel. It was a challenge to him to do that, to tweet it out. What about saying that Uber is ethically challenged? You got some heat for that too, because I guess you're an investor in
Lyft. I always disclose I'm an investor in Lyft. I'm quite biased on this. It's obviously been this ferocious competition between the two companies. There's sort of all sorts of allegations of Uber, calling drivers at Lyft and then canceling the rides. All sorts of things like that. And so there always are questions how far you can push the ethical rules in business. And I think there is a line. It's not clear Uber's gone over the line, but they've gotten awfully close to it.
We get to our emails and our callers. One last question, just out of my own curiosity, and it has nothing to do with any of these provocative things, but we've had Ray Kurzweil on, and I know you're a supporter of the Singularity Project. Would you like to see immortality? Would you like to see life extended technologically, just even beyond? Because we've got some serious sustainable problems if we keep adding to the longevity.
Well, certainly, I think the only ethical thing is to keep working on longevity. It's not going to take the form of having a single pill that makes you live forever. It's going to be, do we take this cure for cancer? Do we find a way to cure Alzheimer's or prevent dementia? And I think in every single instance, the ethical answer is always yes. There may be problems of one sort or another that come with this, but I think the ethical answer is always to go with medicine.
Did you read Zeke Emanuel's piece about this? This is a brother, of course, of Rahm Emanuel, who is a medical doctor.
And, yes. Yeah. Well, it's obviously if you say that you want to die by the time you're 75, that will always get sensational interest, but. But I think, that's a terrible thing, a terrible mindset to have. I want to live as though my life's going to go on forever. I don't know if it will, but I don't want to live as though it's going to be my last day ever.
I remember Richard Lamb, former governor of Colorado, said the leaves fall off the tree and new leaves have to come in their place. I mean, we do have some carrying capacity and sustainability problems, you would concede.
Well, people always say that death is a natural part of life, that it's natural. To which I always respond that it is equally natural for us to resist death. And
good line. Let me go to some comments. A listener writes, I just finished Mr. Thiel's book and I really enjoyed it, especially his scathing comments about some of the legacy Silicon Valley companies like HP that are struggling because of very bad strategic decisions. Perhaps he could elaborate. Why are there so many large established firms in the IT industry, for example, HP, Cisco, Microsoft, with so few recent innovations?
I'm always a big fan of founder-led companies. I think when the founders lead companies, they're able to still really push the envelope on the product side, on the creative side. You had Apple Computer, sort of an interesting microcosm of this, where between jobs, between 85 and 97, they had five different CEOs come in. And you actually need to have Jobs come back to sort of really shift course and go from a home computer company to a consumer electronics company. And so I think if you looked at the systematically, you'd find that a lot of the founder-led ones, Google, Facebook, Amazon, are innovating quite significantly. And then when they're not founder-led, you seem to get these politicians masquerading as CEOs running them that are always interested in not rocking the boat, in having smooth rise in the quarterly earnings every 3 months. And often underinvesting in really building the future.
What do you think of CEO salaries?
I suspect they're way too high. I think on the startup side, I've always been an advocate of very modest cash salaries. I think there's sort of has been this weird ratcheting up on the public company side. I'm more partial to some equity compensation, but I think the cash compensation is generally way too high.
Let me go through some emails with you before we go to our callers. Listener writes, he seems to be saying democracy is not scalable. Astounding from someone so steeped in information technology.
It's we still haven't figured out how to deal with all the information in the world. So it's not just a governance problem. People generally find themselves overwhelmed with information, and so as the information revolution has proceeded, the challenge of figuring out what to do with all the information is one that's endemic in all fields, not just politics.
Another listener says, I'm sorry if this is a dumb question, but people are saying that PayPal might be more innovative standing on its own, but eBay has long been regarded as an innovative company. You're the expert in these matters. Why would splitting a PayPal make it more innovative?
The claim would be that you could have one company focus on payments, one company focus on the e-commerce side, I think within these businesses it's often hard to sort of equally focus on multiple different things. In theory you can do that. In practice there's often sort of a center of attention, and that's sort of what attracts the most talented people in a given company, and it's often hard to have multiple centers.
Again, our guest is Peter Thiel, and he'll be at the Commonwealth Club tonight in Santa Clara at 7. Listener wants to know, can you comment on Ayn Rand and objectivism?
Well, I say in my book that I think—
You have something in Paul Ryan in common here. You both adore Ayn Rand.
Well, I actually say that I think she's only a half-great writer. So I do think—
She's a lousy writer. I speak with my literary hat.
Yeah, but the books, that you read them, they're page-turners. They're somewhat suspenseful. I think the villains are real, but I think the heroes are fake, because I think that I don't think we have these—
You know John Galt?
There are no sort of semi-divine, unmoved mover heroes. That does not exist. I believe founders are important, but they're important because they bring out the best in other people, and because of the way they help pull together teams of people, not because they do everything themselves.
One more quick listener question, then we'll go to your calls. Do you remain in touch with Elon Musk, and what is your opinion of electric vehicles and the relationship between Tesla and SolarCity? Especially with respect to fossil fuel addiction.
I see Elon a few times a year. We are large investors in his SpaceX company. We're also investors in SolarCity. I think Tesla is a phenomenally impressive company. Not sure exactly how big the synergies are between Tesla and SolarCity. There's some overlap between them, but I think you should probably think of each of them as really standalone businesses.
You were being a little modest when you said you didn't know if you should take on the mantle of being a public intellectual, but one mantle that you do have is you're a billionaire. And I wonder, just always ask people sometimes who I encounter who have made fortunes like you have, does it sometimes put you in a different sphere? And by that I mean You know, you have a lot of people kissing up to you. You have a lot of people wanting to please you, a lot of sycophantic behavior. And also, you know, I've heard billionaires say it can be very isolating to be extremely affluent because you don't know who your friends are sometimes.
Yeah, it's it always feels very wrong to complain about it in any way whatsoever. Money is always a very strange thing. And you know, most of the time we feel like we don't have enough of it. And then when we have enough or more than enough, it also leads to all sorts of other weird dynamics. I think there's always a lot of very weird stuff that surrounds money, either its absence or its excess.
That's well said. But I guess I was also asking, does it sometimes feel like a bit of an albatross?
Sure. There always are questions. Do people have ulterior motives of one sort or another? And you know, among my wealthy friends, there's sort of a range of responses people have. I try to not second guess people's motives too much all the time. I want to sort of avoid the super paranoid modality. And you know, occasionally people take advantage of me, and so be it.
You notice how different, though. I was just opining on this the other day. The cultures are in New York. We have these stretch limos and all that sort of thing. I don't see much of that in Silicon Valley. You come in here wearing a T-shirt, looking very like a regular guy. I mean, it's just something about showing off money back in the East that doesn't necessarily translate as much out here in the West Coast.
It varies a lot from place to place. So I think Manhattan, that's very true. It's probably a lot less true once you're even in, say, New England. So you think of New England as being sort of much more circumspect about it. So it's there are some really interesting cultural differences in different parts
of the
U.S.
That's the Puritan heritage. I often think about a gold bull I saw in Southampton, and it was inscribed, "Nouveau is better than no riche at all." And I've stayed in my mind for many years now. Let me go to our callers. We'll begin with a caller from Napa. Laura, join us. Hi.
Hi. How are you guys doing today? Let me preface this with, I am an entrepreneur. I own my own business. I am a college dropout. I also still work in a wine bar in San Francisco a couple nights a week that is kind of a hub for tech meetings and tech people coming in, called Hotel Biron. And frequently I notice that the people who seem to have gone to college or have some kind of cultural awareness have much better ways of communicating. And I guess my question is, for the people that you're advising don't go to college and don't receive some type of engagement with the liberal arts, how do you suggest they learn how to communicate and kind of correspond with other people in the people world versus the internet?
You know, if you're an entrepreneur and starting a business, I'm always a big fan of the two-person model, where one person's more on the business side, one person's more on the technical side, and you actually have some division of labor between these things. You know, a great engineer is often not a great salesman, and sometimes they are combined, like they are with Steve Jobs or maybe with Elon Musk. But most of the time, I think these are extremely different skill sets. And
salesmen are the ones that wear the suits, right?
Or the bad salesmen. Used car dealers wear suits.
Thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. Actually, appropriate with that. One listener writes here, the term entrepreneur or being entrepreneurial has become buzzwords. What is Peter Thiel's definition of the term?
I strongly agree with that sentiment. One of my friends, I asked him a few years ago what he wanted to be doing, and he said, well, in 10 years, it's clear I want to be an entrepreneur. And that's always, I think, a very bad answer. It's sort of like saying, I want to be rich, I want to be famous. I think people should start new companies because they have important problems to solve, and the best way to do it is in a new venture rather than in some large existing organization. And I think you should never think of it as just a line item on your resume. It's way too much stress to justify that.
We go to more of your calls, and let me go up to Auburn. Edmund, you're on. Good morning. Edmund, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, first time caller, long time listener here. I had a question for Peter. How do you get in front of, you can have a great idea, you can have a billion-dollar idea that can resolve a major issue, but you can't get in front of someone like yourself or, you know, a Google executive because there's multiple layers that you have to go through.
Okay.
This is always an enormous challenge. When we started PayPal, the first angel financing round was in February of 1999. We raised $500,000. We then had, you know, the company took off. 13 months later, we raised $100 million in around, you know, several financing rounds later. It was easier to raise the $100 million than the first half million. And so it is always incredibly hard to get started. And I think one of the things that that's always a risk for people who've been successful is to actually to somewhat forget how hard it was. You always sort of tend to not remember all the real challenges that one had. But that is that this is, you know, I think the sales part of this is always really critical. It's never automatic.
And thank you for the call. I mean, we'll go to more callers in a moment. But as a philosophy major and a man of some learning, you probably know the word eleemosynary. It's a word I once threw out on the air, and people had a whole good time with it.
Yes.
It just means, you know, being philanthropic, being caring about other people and so forth. Does that – I mean, you've built a foundation. You actually, in fact, I'd like to find out more about it. I've been involved with a committee to protect journalists. I've done a lot of, in other words, eleemosynary work or charitable work. What about these libertarians who argue that this is not the province even of the most wealthy people? You know, everybody has to get up off their own duff and so forth. And why provide help when people need to help themselves? I came up with Paul Ryan kind of, so I'm bringing it up with you.
Well, it's there obviously are many exceptions to this. I doubt they would treat their own kids that way. And then you know, I think there are a lot of, you know, you don't want charity to be counterproductive, but I think there are a lot of things that have the nature of a public good that if they don't actually. You know, they don't necessarily come out of the mechanisms of the market, and then you know, some of them can be done by government. Some of them require nonprofits. I think it's always a good question when should you have nonprofits versus government? And my general answer is always that it should be non-conventional things that you should nonprofits should fund should prioritize unpopular causes because in a you know, representative democracy, the popular causes get funding. The unpopular ones do not.
Another listener wants to know who your favorite philosopher is and why.
Favorite philosopher is a professor I ran across at Stanford named René Girard, who had this mimetic theory on the role imitation plays in so much of our interactions
it's
with
very important
with
to those of us who study literature, literary scholars as well, a very important figure. You know?
And so, the word ape already in the time of Shakespeare meant both primate and to imitate, and the degree to which we end up copying the people around us is I think much greater than we often acknowledge. It's this thing that's sort of we always pretend that we're on our own, that we're thinking for ourselves, that advertising is something that only works on other people, never on ourselves. But I think the reality is that this is a very powerful force. It's good in the sense that this is how culture gets transmitted. It's how language gets learned. And then there are many cases where it's problematic. It leads to bubbles. It leads to lemming-like behavior. And so I think there are sort of both good and bad things about it.
Just observe the primates, right? The simians, I mean, in terms of imitative aping behavior, as you say. All kinds of behavior, really. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Rajiv from Saratoga. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. So, Peter, I just got your book, just got started. It's pretty interesting, pretty insightful. So my question is, you know, the distinction you draw between monopolistic technology creating unique value, right? Is the system, especially in the values in the valley, set up for espousing and supporting such you know unique value propositions, especially if you don't have credentials. You know, Reed, you're not a Stanford or Harvard dropout, right? So, in which case you end up in the other camp, which is you know competition, and you know it's somewhat self-sustaining this model. So, I wonder what your thoughts are.
I think there always are challenges with getting anything unique started. It sounds too weird. It sounds too different. It's often harder to attract employees. It's harder to attract investors. So there are often these businesses are somewhat more difficult to get started at the very beginning. But I think they're, you know, I'm optimistic in the sense that I think that there is some way to do it. But I think it's always at best hard.
And we thank you for the call. We're talking to Peter Thiel, and his book again is called Zero to One: Notes on Startups or How to Build the Future. Scott Schaefer, colleague and man we know for the California Report, KQED personality, wanted to ask you a question, which I will honor him with. Given how politically blue the Bay Area is, how tough is it to express points of view that might be considered politically incorrect here?
It's always a little bit tough, but I think that for the most part, people don't care that much about politics in these things. So I think it would be tougher to express.
Does that include Berkeley?
You know, I think it's tougher to express politically incorrect views in a liberal college. It's harder to express them in a conservative small town in Alabama. So in a place where people intensely care about politics, it becomes harder to do so. I think it's not something people care that much about.
We'll bring in more of your calls. We'll go next to you, Phil in Santa Rosa. Join us.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. Peter, I wanted to ask you about vocational training. College is a great choice for many people, for a lot of kids I've known. I know other kids that they're just simply not going to do that. You know, they can't, they won't. Sex, math is not interesting. I'm 57. When I went to school, there was a wood shop and an auto shop and welding and whatnot. And I feel like Californian high school students especially are not being well served. The whole focus seems to be on, we're going to get you to college, and the kids who do well with that do great, but the other kids are sort of shunted off to the side. And I wonder what you're feeling about a more diverse vocational type training or manufacturing apprentice training like they have in Germany, for example.
I think there's a lot to be said for the German model. The concern is always that people get tracked also very, very early on that. But the reality is that people in the U.S. often all get sent to college. You know, we have like something like 40% of the people who start college don't actually finish it. So they're often not much better off than people who would have just graduated high school. And so I do think that having a lot more good options is very important. You know, it's not always just about creating jobs. It's about creating, well-paying middle-class jobs.
And I thank the caller. Another listener writes, regarding Mr. Thiel's well-known perspective on a college education, it seems slightly disingenuous for a man with 2 Stanford degrees to diminish the value of those stamps on his resume. Undoubtedly, those degrees were extremely valuable early in his career in terms of building credibility with potential investors and business partners. Please ask him how he thinks about the balance between the signaling value of a respected college degree and the downside of the time required to earn said sheepskin.
Well, I think it is. I think the signaling value is high. It's the status value is high. The concern, of course, is that the learning is not quite as high. One of the strange things, I do think all the elite universities still people get a lot out of them who go there, but it's a lot of the signaling and the selection rather than the learning. And the easy way to show this is that if you were president of any of these universities, Stanford, Harvard, and you wanted to get fired right away, What all you'd have to propose is that you double enrollment over the next 10 or 15 years, and you'd get a coalition of faculty and students and alumni all against you, because so much of the value comes from the sort of exclusion, that it functions like a nightclub with an extremely long line and, you know, very, very vigorously guarded velvet rope.
Well, not enough bouncers, perhaps. But what about the MOOCs? You like them?
I think there are
learning online. Yeah,
yeah. I think the business models are still not clear how well they're going to do as businesses. But I think we're in a period of tremendous ferment, and those of us who are tied to the top universities probably underestimate it, because I think the MOOCs aren't going to challenge a Stanford or a Harvard. They are challenging sort of the many other universities where people are amassing lots of student debt, and the signaling or the learning doesn't cut it.
Listener says, could you ask Peter if he has any ideas or opinions regarding the great disparity in income and wealth in this nation? I'm employed in San Francisco at $10.75 an hour and park cars. I have a degree of BA just like Peter in philosophy.
Yeah, there's a big inequality problem. It's there are important questions. What causes it? I tend to think it's more caused by globalization than technology, even though a lot of people blame technology. And then there are very tricky questions what to do about it. I'm always of the bias that the stagnation issue is the somewhat more important one, and that the reason a lot of people are frustrated is not because of the inequality, but because of the sense of stagnation, that they can't move ahead, that their kids aren't doing better.
You mean stagnation or just immobility, being in a paralytic state of being not able to move forward?
Economic immobility.
Yeah.
That you have a low salary, it's not going up, and so I think it's the sort of sense of stagnation, the lack of growth.
Lack of opportunity,
lack of growth in the whole society. That's that I would focus on.
Well, again, you can actually meet Peter Thiel. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club tonight in Santa Clara at 7 o'clock p.m. And next Monday, October 6th at 7 p.m., he'll be at the JCC in San Francisco. And again, his book is 0 to 1, Notes on Startups or How to Build the Future. Very good to have you with us. Grateful for your being here.
Michael, thanks for having me on the show.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We remind you, you can continue this conversation online by going to kqed.org/forum, and you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Get online support from David Marks, and senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED, thank you for joining us in this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.